Physics World.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm General Physics Editor Hamish Johnston, and this week we're going to learn that the habitable zone, now that's the area around a star that can support life, could be much smaller than previously thought. We're also going to have a chat about the television miniseries Chernobyl. But first is a preview of the second knockout round of the Battle of the Elements, which celebrates 2019 as the International Year of the Periodic Table. Over the past few weeks, 9 Physics World editors have been arguing the cases for their favorite elements. Now, we've put those elements into 3 groups, and we will be asking you, dear reader, to pick your favorite. Here to champion elements in the second group are Anna Deming, who will argue the case for carbon, and Michael Banks, who will explain why helium is not an elemental lightweight. But first, Tammy Freeman will sing the praises of technetium.
So, as the medical physics editor for Physics World, I had to pick technetium as my favourite element. More specifically, I chose its metastable nuclear isomer, technetium-99m, which is tricky to say, but stick with me. So technetium-99m is used in tens of millions of medical diagnostic procedures every year, about 80% of all nuclear medicine procedures worldwide. As such, it's helping to save people's lives on a daily basis. So why is it used so much? Well, technetium-99m is a perfect fit for medical imaging. So it decays by emitting gamma rays, which have an energy of 140 keV, and these can be easily detected using a standard gamma camera. It can be incorporated into different molecules to target different systems in the body. And it also has a relatively short physical half-life of 6 hours and a biological half-life of about a day, which makes it ideal for use in diagnostic imaging procedures, because as soon after the procedure ends, there's no radioactivity left in the body. So one key application, for example, is myocardial perfusion imaging, which is basically a way of diagnosing heart disease. So how this works is a technetium-based radiopharmaceutical is injected into the patient, and then the gamma rays emitted from inside the body are used to create images of the heart muscle. And this is done twice, with the patient at rest and then the patient doing exercise, and then the doctors compare the resulting images and they can assess blood flow through the heart. Now, that's just one example. There's many, many other important medical procedures that use technetium-99m. These include whole body imaging to detect bone metastases, sentinel node imaging before surgery for breast cancer or melanoma, as well as imaging of the thyroid, brain and the lung. So technetium-99m, it certainly lives up to its reputation as the workhorse isotope of nuclear medicine. Now, just going to give you a little bit of history. Technetium-99m is made by the decay of molybdenum-99. Now, molybdenum-99 has a half-life of 66 hours, so this makes it much easier to transport it to different hospitals than something that only lasts a few hours. However, molybdenum-99 is traditionally generated in nuclear reactors, and this has created a few problems in the past. Around a decade ago, the nuclear medicine field experienced a large supply shortage caused by a couple of these aging reactors being simultaneously shut down for extended periods. Now, to address this vulnerability, governments and industries have since taken action to improve the reliability of this supply chain. So several countries are planning to develop new production facilities. There's new agreements in place for backup production and supply. And also, several companies are developing alternative production methods that can make molybdenum-99 without having to use uranium targets. So everyone's working together to make the market much more reliable. So to sum up, as the most widely used medical radioisotope, the need for technetium-99m is clear, and everyone's working hard to safeguard its supply. With these efforts, technetium-99m is set to continue making an invaluable and significant impact on the lives of patients across the globe, which is why I urge you to vote for it as your favourite element.
Well, thanks, Tammy. A life-saving element. And now, moving on to helium. So, Michael, why should helium win the battle of the elements?
Well, I was actually half tempted to inhale some helium and deliver this with a very high-pitched voice, but
that would have been great.
But I'll save you that, and I'll deliver it in my rather monotone voice instead. So the reason why I picked helium, there's kind of two reasons for that. The first one is because of how crucial it is to physics research. So when I was doing my PhD, there were basically helium jars everywhere, all around the lab. And that was kind of the first indication to me of how crucial helium was to, you know, getting research out there and doing research. And it was such a vital part of the whole kind of research process. So helium is used to, how we used it then was to kind of cool down the equipment so that we could cool down the materials that we were studying to study their kind of interesting and varied properties. So it's kind of used for that, but then also you have it used quite often for at big science labs and facilities where it's used to cool down the superconducting magnets. So for example, CERN's Large Hadron Collider, that required around 130 tons of helium to cool down the 27 kilometer circumference accelerator to 1.9 Kelvin. So that's kind of, helium is basically the enabler of all this science and all these results that come from it. So that's kind of one reason why I chose helium. The second reason actually is for its kind of quite bizarre properties itself. So one is superfluidity, in which the superfluid can flow without losing kinetic energy. And this is kind of a weird phenomena, similar to superconductivity, in which the electrons flow without resistance. So helium has two natural isotopes, helium-4 and helium-3, and both of these share that unique property of superfluidity. And researchers for many years have tried to kind of understand that kind of bizarre property of helium, and it's led to many Nobel Prizes. So some of the really big names in physics have been studying it. For example, you've had Lev Landau, Antony Leggett, and Peter Kapitsa. They've all shared Nobel Prizes for their work on helium. So basically it's those two reasons of why I chose helium. One is it's so crucial for physics research, and two, because it has such unique properties itself.
Thank you, Michael, for that compelling argument about helium. And now we're on to Anna, who's going to make the argument for carbon.
Yes, so to argue carbon's case in the battle of the elements, I'd like to start by asking our listeners, what are you doing now? What will you be doing next week, next year, a million years from now? Because without a shadow of a doubt, I can assure you that whatever it is, it revolves around carbon in some form. Carbon literally breathes life into human existence. In terms of compounds, it is one of the most promiscuous elements in the periodic table. And these are not just esoteric substances intriguing only to a few elite specialists. Carbon is the backbone of organic chemistry. I know this is physics world, but take a look at the bonding and emergent properties and you'll realise what fascinating physics unfolds from organic chemistry, never mind the fact that the matter you and I and every other living organism is made of is underpinned by organic chemistry. So I would argue that carbon is not just saving lives, carbon is life itself. But if you find biology too mucky, uncontained, squelchy, take diamonds. I can just feel the twinkle in some of the listeners' eyes as I speak, because diamond is pure carbon crystal, an extremely hard material that glitters and gleams. Sure, gold is the band that binds people in lawful wedlock, but the gem that symbolises the desire to be bound in lifelong union. Diamonds are forever. And they help thoughts too. Well, carbon helps thoughts. One of the first data storage devices developed in the 17th century and still in use today exploits carbon. Yes, the pencil. The lead running through pencils is graphite layers of carbon crystal bonded together sufficiently loosely that the friction of running the lead over a piece of paper can dislodge layers of the graphite and leave a trail of graphite to record your thoughts. But of course, carbon devices get a lot more sophisticated. By isolating single layers of graphite, you get graphene, often portrayed as some sort of superhero because of it's so extreme. Anything that you can characterize, electronic, optical, mechanical, you name it, if you can characterize it, graphene will dazzle with it. Roll up graphene and you get carbon nanotubes, already well immersed in the consumer landscape for the strength they offer in composites and so on. And then diamonds, we're back to the diamonds. If you take a pure diamond and then put a few impurities in it, sure, the pure diamond might make a nice piece of jewelry, but with impurities, you get a whole new set of properties. You get spin interactions and things that you can make different types of microscopes and quantum computers. And that is just the tip of the iceberg for carbon soil and material science. Interested listeners, there's much more where that came from, so take a look at our materials portal on Physics World for more. But carbon inspires and facilitates our weekday toil. It lends endurance to fleeting ideas and promise to our loved ones. But carbon is not just with us till death do us part. When we die and we're buried, we give back to the earth through the carbon cycle. The carbon cycle helps to balance all the gases in the air so that the CO2 is then feeds the plants, which then feed the animals, which then give back to the earth with the CO2. And this careful balance means that we get the right amount of CO2 for the right amount of insulation on the earth. And it's this kind of knocking the balance of CO2 out of kilter that people is causing people so much concern at the moment. Because if you press people under the earth, into the bowels of the earth for millions of years, that's where you get the fossil fuels from. That's what I was talking about when I asked what you're doing a million years from now, because if you're lucky and if the planet hasn't been obliterated into oblivion, you will be preparing fossil fuels for future generations. So I tell you, reluctantly though it might be, you cannot escape the fact that carbon dominates whatever sphere of activity you're in. And I'd like to leave you with a misquote from Audrey Hepburn. If I were dead and buried and I heard your voice, carbon, beneath the sod my heart of dust would still rejoice.
Thanks, Anna. That was fantastic.
Is it a little too impassioned?
No, not at all. So what's it going to be in the second group? Is it going to be a life-saving technetium? Is it going to be that coolest of customers, helium? Or is it going to be ubiquitous carbon? So there you have the arguments in the second knockout round of our Battle of the Elements. You can vote for your favorite out of carbon, helium, and technetium on our Twitter feed. Thanks, guys, for joining us. And now I'm joined by my fellow editor, James Dacey, to reveal the results of last week's Twitter poll about three elements. Now, in the first round, we put gold, silicon, and uranium up against each other. And now I can reveal the results of our Twitter poll. Even though it's worth a fortune, and everybody would like a little bit of it, gold was actually in third place with only 25% of the votes.
Ooh.
Uranium, oh, that was yours, James, wasn't it?
That was, yeah, it's worth its weight in gold.
In second place, we have uranium. And so that means, with 36% of the vote, and that means with an amazing 39% of the vote, silicon is last week's winner. So we'll have to see who wins this week.
Yeah, I have to hand it to Susan then. It was Susan Curtis who presented that element. And I think one of her key arguments was that it's the material that's the backbone of, I suppose, computing. So fair play, you know, it's quite an important element.
And of course, uranium is the backbone of the nuclear power industry. And recently, there's been a fantastic, can I say it's fantastic? Can I promote something? Television miniseries called Chernobyl.
Yeah, it's a fantastic program about an unfortunate event.
That's right. Yes, a tragedy in many, many ways. You've been watching this Chernobyl, James, and I've watched it. What do you think of it?
Yeah, so I should say up front that I've only seen 3 episodes, so please don't spoil it too much. Although, obviously, it's based on true events, so a bit like the Titanic, we know what happens. But yeah, no, I think it's fantastically made, and it's like good dramas evolved around science. There is lots of physics in there, but it's not shoved in your face. It's the main thing is a great human story about the events that keeps you gripped throughout, while they do manage to get some physics into it as well.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing that I really liked about the miniseries is that there are sort of 3 main characters, 3 heroes, who go to Chernobyl and you know, try to sort things out, figure out what happened. And 2 of those heroes are physicists. One of them is called Valery Legasov, and that's actually a real character. There was a Soviet physicist called Valery Legasov. He's played by Jared Harris, the English actor. And then there was another character called Ulana Komyuk, who's played by Emily Watson, also an English actor. And she actually wasn't real. There was no Ulania Komyuk. But she's sort of a composite of lots of physicists who did an incredible amount of research after the disaster to try to work out what happened.
So she's the character, isn't she, in what was Belarusia, and she detects that something's going on at Chernobyl at the moment when it's all been kept under wraps, isn't it? The extent of the tragedy.
That's right, yeah. Chernobyl is sort of in the far north of the Ukraine, and it's very close to the
Belarus border. Yeah, I hadn't realised how close it was. It's right on the border, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. And at the time, the wind was blowing. I think the wind was blowing sort of north and west.
Would that be the prevailing wind, wouldn't it?
No, actually, the prevailing wind, well, not normally the prevailing wind in Europe blows from the west.
Yeah.
So if the prevailing wind had been blowing, all that nasty stuff would have been blown towards Russia. And, you know, I suppose you could speculate that perhaps people outside of the Soviet Union, it would have taken longer for people to realize what happened at Chernobyl, because I believe the first indications came from Sweden.
Yeah, that's mentioned, isn't it?
Yeah, so the wind blew all that nasty stuff north and west up to Sweden. But if the prevailing winds had been happening at the time, it would have blown it in the other direction. And perhaps, the story would have played out differently in terms of how we discovered Chernobyl. But yeah, she was, there's a great scene where, now I don't know if this bit is true, I mean, it might be a bit of an exaggeration, where Ulana Komyuk is in her office with a colleague, and they open the window to get some fresh air, and their radiation detectors go off, and she takes a swipe of the dust on the outside of the window and tests it, and discovers radioactive elements that can be traced to a power reactor. And that's how she, you know, sort of works out that something has gone wrong at the Chernobyl reactor, which is south of where she was in Minsk. Another interesting thing that she did, okay, she didn't do it because she didn't exist, but she was the character in the miniseries who interviewed the operators. These are the people that were running a test at the Chernobyl reactor that went horribly wrong, and the reactor blew up as a result of this test. And she was the person who spoke to these operators and sort of worked out what happened. And between her and Valery Legasov, they worked out that a key safety feature of the reactor didn't function properly. And ultimately, that was the thing that caused the problem. You know, these operators, they're really acting like cowboys, putting the reactor into a situation where it really shouldn't be, in order to do this test, you know, bringing the power down and then trying to get it back up when they shouldn't really have tried to do that. But they were relying on the fact, well, on their belief that they could push this button and everything would stop. And the 2 physicists, heroes, in Chernobyl, they discover that this is flawed.
There's that great scene, isn't there, when there's the, yeah, sort of midway through the inquiry when she's investigating it, and then the KGB member is in the meeting, and Valerie follows him down the corridor, and basically there's this sort of slightly cryptic conversation in there about how, so long as he can vouch for her as someone who's not going to undermine the regime too much, and he does, but it just gives you a little insight into the politics of the era and just the massive amount of secrecy that surrounded these things.
That's right. Yeah. That was interesting. I mean, I have to say, I've been doing a bit of, I enjoyed Chernobyl so much that I sort of went down a bit of a rabbit hole in terms of doing research. And I did come across, some claims that the way the political system in the Soviet Union was portrayed and the way that scientists were portrayed in the Soviet Union was maybe not quite kosher. And the other thing, when you watch Chernobyl, you realize if you do know anything about sort of health physics, that, a lot of the medical stuff is not quite right. I'm not sure how accurate that is, but with my extremely limited knowledge of how a nuclear reactor works, I was sort of nodding along during the explanation of how the disaster happened, and that's done in a really good way. I suppose this is a bit of a spoiler alert, but the final episode, there's five episodes in the miniseries, and the final episode is dedicated to a physics explanation. Isn't that great? That millions of people. I mean, that's something that I thought was real. I was really happy about that. Millions of people around the world have watched this physics explanation of how a reactor works and how the Chernobyl reactor failed. And so this is done by Valerie Legosov, played by Jared Harris, in a courtroom where he has a very simple set of cards. Red cards for things that make the reactor go faster, and I think blue or green cards for things that make the reactor go slower. And he put these cards up and he took them down and he explained about, the moderator and the control rods and xenon poisoning and how they got, I think it's called a xenon pit, where they took the reactor power down too far and they couldn't get it back up again, and unless they did something really stupid, and that's what they did. And
wasn't it a bit like a few years ago there was the it's a dramatization of the Challenger disaster inquiry, and Feynman is depicted in that, isn't he? As true to real events, didn't he appear to explain why the O-ring failed on the space?
That's right.
He used a rubber band. So
exactly, in the ice water. Yeah. I think that was, this was a bit of a, I suppose, Feynman moment. Mm. But the interesting thing here is that at least the implication in the television program is that by doing so, by telling the truth, by saying that there is a fundamental flaw in the emergency system. Mm. Of the reactor that didn't allow the operators to shut it down. By saying that, Legosov was essentially ending his career as a scientist. Mm-hmm. And I believe, in the miniseries, right at the beginning, this is not a spoiler, right at the beginning of the miniseries, he commits suicide.
Was it two years to the second after the event, isn't it, I think?
Oh, that's right. In the miniseries it is. Yeah. Whether that happened or not, I don't know. But so I became interested in this. I thought, well, okay, the physics looks okay to me, my basic understanding of reactor physics. But I sort of looked around the internet, the font of all knowledge, and I couldn't really find any criticism of how the physics was explained in the miniseries. So I'm happy to be corrected. But I think it was is probably pretty good.
But you wonder if they used science advisors, like I know they have done in certain high-profile films. Well, there was a piece on the BBC I saw, which was looking at some of the things in the series that were true and some that perhaps weren't. And I know one of the things they mentioned, I remember, was there's that great scene, it's a tragic scene really, where when the fire is burning, when a reactor core is on fire, and you've got all the locals come out.
Oh, the bridge of death.
And the bridge, and you see this dust, this radioactive dust floating over them. And they interviewed someone who had lived in the town at that time, and he said that that probably didn't happen because it was the middle of the night, wasn't it? It was supposed to be sort of 2-3 a.m.
That's right. Yeah, it happened the test went over midnight.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, yeah, the reactor blew up early in the morning.
Yeah. So I mean, there were some very serious long term health impacts on the locals, but I don't know if they were, you know, stood there staring at this fire at that moment.
So I've written a blog on the website about Chernobyl, the mini series, and I've got some there's some references there to articles about how true it is to real events, and I've also linked to a video where a physicist based in California does a sort of very extended explanation of what went wrong with the Chernobyl reactor on that dreadful night.
Yeah.
So yeah, have a look at that. And James, I understand that we've got some more audio coming up about Chernobyl, specifically about the health physics.
Yeah, that's right. So I recently interviewed a guy called Richard Wakeford. So he's the editor of the Journal of Radiological Protection. So that's a journal that is published by IOP Publishing, which also publishes Physics World. So in that interview, we talk about the longer term potential impacts of exposure to radiation. So I think it's still a field where, you know, we know, as is depicted in the series, there's very, very serious short-term effects of radiation sickness if you're exposed to a huge amount where the radiation actually damages. They explain it, don't they, in the series. It actually breaks down the cells and there's some horrible scenes.
Very gruesome scenes, yeah. Firefighters and people who are in the plant.
Yeah, people, they start to recover, don't they? But then the damage is already done and their skin just dissolves, basically, doesn't it? That's horrific. But yeah, there were obviously well-documented longer-term impacts on the local environment. So I know the iodine got into the ground and it got into the milk supply, and there were...
Yeah, that's very dangerous because, of course, people pick up iodine. We need iodine as an element.
Yeah, so there are lots of cases of thyroid cancer, which I think, thankfully, in most cases isn't lethal, but it still had this huge, huge impact. So in that interview, we talk about Chernobyl in the longer term, but also what happened more recently at Fukushima, so in Japan, and the lessons learned from Chernobyl that were then applied to Fukushima, which, you know, by all accounts was nowhere near on the same scale in terms of the actual disaster itself. But yeah, there were lots of lessons learned around things such as how to evacuate and the amount of land that needs to be evacuated. So that will be coming up on this podcast in the next few weeks.
So James is going to stick around and we'll have a little chat about what's new on the website this week.
So yeah, I noticed there was a really interesting article about the habitable zone around sun. So that's also known as the Goldilocks zone, because it's where the conditions are just right for life to emerge, or life as we know it, at least. So this article seems to be saying that there might be another factor in determining whether this is a Goldilocks zone.
Yeah, this is, yeah. So the habitable zone is the area around a star where, if there were a planet there, life could exist on that planet. And this is becoming a really important part of research for planetary science, because we're learning about more and more planets, or we're discovering more and more planets orbiting distant stars. And it would be very nice to know if there's a possibility that life could exist on one of those planets.
It's also, I think, because the James Webb telescope is going to be the successor to Hubble, really, isn't it? And that's going to be trying to identify exoplanets, so planets beyond our solar system that could harbour life.
That's right, yeah. And of course, you need to know where to point your telescope. So normally the habitable zone is defined by how much energy the star is given out and how close the planet is to the star. That's sort of the basic idea. So if the planet is too close to the star, it's too hot, and you won't have any liquid water existing on the planet. And if the planet's too far out, It's too cold and everything's frozen and it's too cold for life. So as you say, there's a not too hot, not too cold Goldilocks zone that exists. And of course, the Earth is within the Goldilocks zone of the sun, or at least we hope it is, if we understand what
for now, anyway.
Goldilocks zone means. But the Earth is actually an interesting example because, of course, it's not just water that's important. There are lots of other gases in the Earth's atmosphere and liquids. And this latest research was done by scientists at the University of California, and they looked at the presence of toxic gases, or at least these are gases that are toxic to life as we know it, if I can use that term. Carbon monoxide, which of course is very toxic, and carbon dioxide as well. And what they've shown is that you can have significant amounts of these gases on a planet within the habitable zone, or within what we would define as a habitable zone. And they're making the argument that the presence of these gases would preclude the emergence of life. And so the idea is that the habitable zone might be much smaller than we previously thought, which means that it's less likely that life exists on a planet at a near surrounding a nearby star. And they're actually saying that in some cases, stars that we previously thought had habitable zones don't actually have habitable zones. And I think these are very dim stars.
But are these gases coming from the geology of the planet itself, or are they coming from a solar wind from the star?
Well, I'm guessing that like Earth, you know, there's carbon and oxygen, and those elements combine together to produce carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide. And in one interesting case that they looked at planetary systems that are around stars that are dimmer than the sun. And, you know, some of these stars have planets in the habitable zone. But I think the TRAPPIST-1 system is a famous example of that, where there's quite a few planets surrounding this star. And what these researchers have calculated is that the light from the star is too dim to destroy carbon monoxide in the atmosphere. And I think that's what happens on Earth. That's why carbon monoxide doesn't build up in Earth's atmosphere. It gets destroyed by sunlight. And on these planets with very dim stars, there isn't enough light to destroy the carbon monoxide. And so it would build up. And they're suggesting that these stars may have no habitable zone. You know, for example, the TRAPPIST-1 system, even though there are planets that we think could have life, the existence of too much carbon monoxide might wipe out.
Is that based on the, you know, the old age assumption that we're looking for life which looks exactly like us? So, I mean, even on Earth, I mean, obviously, it's bad news if you've got a carbon monoxide leak in your house, but would a woodlouse care if there was carbon monoxide? I mean, does it affect all life as we know it on Earth?
Well, I don't know the question to that. I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, they seem to be suggesting in their paper that you know, certain levels of carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide would preclude the emergence of life completely. And you're right. Yeah, that is an assumption just based on Earth. we don't know how life has emerged elsewhere. And I suppose we do assume that it would be similar to Earth. But yeah, that's a good question. And you can read more about this work in a news article called "Toxic Gases in Habitable Zone Could Hinder the Emergence of Alien Life." And that's by regular contributor Michael Allen.
Yeah, so I see our regular environment correspondent, Dave Elliott, has also written about the cost of energy.
Yeah, that's right. David, in his regular column, he's talking about cost, which, of course, is very important when you're trying to change over from a fossil fuel economy to a renewable economy. It's going to cost something. And he takes a look at some of the factors that impact the cost of energy. You know, for example, there are things like green levies, falling power use. Of course, you know, if your home is better insulated, you're going to be using less power to heat it. And so he takes a look at some of the cost implications.
Is that just in the UK or on a global scale?
The article is very UK focused, although he does mention the US, Germany, and other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and I see on the medical section of the site, there's an article about a diagnostic tool for looking at human lungs.
Yeah, this is an article called Miniature Probe Measures Tissue Health Deep Inside the Lung. And that's by Tammy Freeman, who, of course, joined us earlier to argue for technetium. In this article, she describes a tiny etched optical fiber that has microspheres on the end of it. And these microspheres, when the fiber is placed into the lung, can detect things such as the pH, oxygen levels, etc. And this, the researchers hope, can provide some really important information about lungs and diseases like pneumonia and also injuries to lungs. So yeah, you can read about that on the website.
And yeah, there's a bit of a blast from the past in the material section, isn't there? Looking at a really early form of photography known as daguerreotype, and that's now been applied to a cutting-edge area of science.
Yeah, daguerreotypes are a very early form of photography. So in a daguerreotype, the image is reproduced by light scattering off of nanostructures. And that's where the connection to plasmonics is. Plasmonics is an effect whereby light interacts with the electrons at the surface of a metal. And so that's the connection between plasmonics and daguerreotypes. And by studying the plasmonics of the nanostructures in these old daguerreotypes, researchers hope to be able to gain a better understanding of how the daguerreotype works. And that should help them preserve them so future generations can enjoy them. And in the article on the website, there's a lovely daguerreotype, I suppose, it's not a photograph, of the Acropolis in Athens. Have you been there?
Yeah, well, I've got family out there in Athens, and they've got a flat with a... Well, it's a bit of a sort of slither of a view of the Acropolis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, still good.
Nice. Well, this photo, I don't know how much it's changed, but this photo was taken in 1842. Sorry, daguerreotype was taken in 1842. And it turns out that daguerreotypes have really interesting optical properties. And these properties come from the plasmonic response of metallic nanostructures that were used to make the daguerreotypes. And I think they were made by somebody called Daguerre. I'm not sure if he actually knew that he was working with metallic nanostructures. But there you go. Now, scientists at the University of New Mexico and the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York have been studying these plasmonic properties of nanostructures with a view for preserving daguerreotypes. And you can read about that study in Daguerreotypes Reveal Their Plasmonic Secrets. And that's by Belle Dume, who is our materials correspondent based in Paris. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of the Physics World Weekly podcast. For more news, in-depth articles, and opinion, check out the Physics World website. And you'll also find more Physics World podcasts there. And you can also hear us on your favorite podcast provider, including Apple Podcast and Spotify. And don't forget to vote for your favorite element on the Physics World Twitter page. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Physics World.